This episode is brought to you by Bombas. Summer's here and we're all chasing something. Maybe it's a break, a goal, a vibe. Well, let's not let bad socks and blisters ruin it. I know in my household, we are not letting that happen because my wife and I love Bombas socks. In fact, it's pretty much all we wear right now because they are such a step up in quality from your usual socks. They are comfortable, they are soft, they are functional, they're not going to fall down during the day, so you have to keep pulling them up. And guess what? They look good too, so maybe you want to look stylish for a wedding. It's wedding season. Well, Bombas has great stuff that's going to make you the best dressed guest. And if you're a runner like Paul, well, Bombas running socks, they wick sweat, they help keep you cool and fight blisters, but they also make specialized pairs for tennis, golf, hiking, you name it. And of course, we all love Bombas Mission, where one pair purchased equals one donated to someone who needs it. Head over to bombas.com and use the code CURB for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com, code CURB at checkout. Bombas.com and use the code CURB. Why do you think people are so give you such a weird look when you tell them you're a psychiatrist?
Well, because they, never mind.
You can answer for him, Stuart.
I can read his mind.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders.
I'm Matt.
The internal medicine podcast that uses expert interviews
as
to bring
opposed
you
to external.
To bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. I'm Dr. Matthew Watto, here with my co-hosts, Dr. Stuart Brigham.
Hello.
And Dr. Paul Williams.
Hey, Matt.
Why are you laughing?
So, what are we going to do tonight, guys?
We're going to talk about DJMC.
Yeah, that's
looking
right.
Looking forward to it.
On this episode, our guest is Dr. Marius Commodore. Dr. Commodore completed medical school at Emory before going through his residencies in internal medicine and psychiatry at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago,
Illinois.
He is dual boarded in internal medicine and psychiatry and is interested in the integration of psychiatry in the general medicine practice as well as in the business of medicine. He has a voice for radio, but a face for public television. Paul wrote that, Dr. Commodore, if you're listening. He cannot be stopped. He can only be contained. He is Marius Commodore.
I hear the conversation is very stimulating.
Well, it is a very stimulating conversation. Just to set it up for the audience, we go through the diagnosis and treatment of depression. Specifically, we talk about how to titrate medications, how to choose your agent, how long the treatment course should be, and pretty much everything you need to know to feel comfortable starting a patient on medication and how to follow them. I think it's a really valuable episode, and please enjoy.
And I'm only sad because we didn't talk about iron.
Sorry, Stuart.
I know.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders.
Hello, Matthew.
Hi. This is your host, Dr. Matthew Watto, here with my co-hosts, Dr. Stuart Brigham.
Hello.
And Dr. Paul Williams.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
And we are so glad to have with us tonight Dr. Marius Commodore from Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia. Hi, Marius. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well, Matt.
Thanks for taking some time away from the family to play around with us on air here.
Oh, not at all. Believe me, this is easy work compared to the family. So I'm happy to be here.
I understand you have had your first child recently.
He is. He's a eating, pooping, sleeping machine.
Wonderful.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, he has from all three basic food groups.
Excellent. Matthew and I are very well versed in all of that.
Yes.
Right. And Matthew in particular, you're quite fecund.
Stuart has more fecund kids than me. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I've got five.
I didn't know that was possible.
Now, I'm not familiar with this word fecund.
I don't know. I like it though.
It seems to have something to do with bearing children. So if that's.
It has to do, right. It means fertile.
Yes, I have had a couple. I have four. Stuart has five. Stuart is more crazy than I am.
That's right.
Wow. I don't know how you guys do it. I only have one. And I'm thinking to myself, vasectomy doesn't sound so bad right now.
Well, vasectomy in my case is probably better than fecundity.
My answer is a wife who is a pretty incredible, and that's I if anything impede I do not help at all. I probably make the kids crazier, but yeah, so I'm spoiled.
Best of health to all of them.
Well, at this point, I would like to kind of jump into the upfront questions we like to ask, our rapid fire questions. You can give us some brief answers to these. When someone asks you what you do, how would you explain that?
Oh, I tell them I'm a psychiatrist because it's just the look on their face is always so classic. But I mean, I think of myself really as just a physician, you know, that I did the double boarding and all of that. But I really like to say that I'm a psychiatrist. It makes for a much better cocktail party.
I would agree. And we've said this many times on the show. Paul's mom still doesn't know what an internist is. She thinks he's like a perpetual intern. Is that right, Paul?
She's not incorrect. I feel like she's not that far off from the truth, actually. So that's more credit to my mom.
It's a labor of lifelong learning, gentlemen. Labor of lifelong learning.
Hmm. How much extra time is it to do the psych board on top of when you're doing those dual boards? How long was your total residency?
The residency was 5 years. So essentially four, if you think of it as 4 month rotations, it was, what is it? 30 rotations of one and 30 rotations of the other. So 1 year longer than a categorical psych residency, 2 years longer than a categorical internal medicine residency.
Yeah. That sounds like a long time. But,
half a decade, man. Half a decade.
So why do you think people are so give you such a weird look when you tell them you're a psychiatrist?
Well, because never mind.
You're going to answer for him, Stuart?
I can read his mind.
Which would be better than being a psychiatrist, actually. But, you know, I think that people sort of don't know what to make. The second question is, are you analyzing me right now? Which is, of course, no, because I've just had a second drink. But I mean, I think people have this sense that you're peering right into them. And sometimes, you know, you're not really, but clearly I'm aware of it enough that I try to use it as some kind of psychological tool. But so, I think people worry about that psychiatrists know something about them that they don't know themselves or that they don't want other people to know. And I don't know if that's the truth at all. I think you just sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
Good answer. What is a book that you think every physician should read?
You know, I don't know if it's been,
it doesn't have to be medical.
Oh, no, it would never. It certainly would never be medical. I think that the book that I really have always loved is 1984. You know, I read it first in high school. I've read it a couple times since then. I just think it is, you know, it's sort of a triumph of anti-totalitarianism in terms of literature. But I also think that it reminds us of the distortions that we're all capable of and the way that we can convince ourselves of things that are not true. So even in medicine, you know, we go for a long time thinking that a certain treatment must be so, this must be the way we do things, and it's not so. So I think it's really important to always be skeptical. And so I think 1984, far and away, is one of my favorite books.
Well, along those lines, what is some of the best advice you've received along the course of your career, whether it was as a learner or as a teacher?
Probably as a learner is always to, and I think I've said this before to trainees. I certainly know I've said it around my colleagues, but nobody sets out to be a crack addict is probably the thing that I remember the most. And I think the professor at the time was trying to remind us to be empathic about the condition that you find the patient in at that time, because nobody set out to be a person with diabetes with an amputation. Nobody set out to be, you know, you can almost fill in anything there, but we were talking about it.
Like psychiatrist.
Right. 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 Nobody set out to be whatever place you find them when they come to you in the office, but you have to meet them where you are in order to try and help them. So I try and keep that in mind and keep that front and center.
I think that's great advice. My team has been struggling at Cashlack at times with very difficult patients, and thinking about how did this person get to be that difficult patient that everybody knows and is kind of lamenting to have on their service. That's a good point.
Which is not to say that I'm not human like everybody else, and that, you know, we all have patients on our list that we see them and we go, oh, we kind of cringe that they're coming in today. But it doesn't matter. It's nothing's going to save you from having to go into the room. So you might as well keep some positive thoughts in your head.
Okay. Stuart's favorite question. Stuart, you want to ask it?
Tell us something about yourself that I personally will never forget.
That you personally will never forget. Huh. For about a year in high school, I was a DJ.
Oh, yeah. Good answer.
That's the single greatest thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
We did. A buddy and I, we were spending every single penny on records. We played a few parties. We were sort of the local, we were the kids who had like the newest music, and we would make a couple mixtapes for people.
Nice.
It was a short-lived career once my parents found out what my allowance was really going to.
I beg of you, please tell me you had a DJ name.
I did not.
Oh, you're killing me.
My career was too short-lived, you know? Like, oh, I wasn't able to carry it out and really let the monster grow inside of me.
Broke my heart. Now I can be on a depression.
You missed your calling. Commodore, Marius Commodore? I mean, come on.
Now that...
DJ MMC, it's right there. It writes itself, Marius.
It's in front of your face.
I know it does.
Well, now that Paul is sufficiently depressed... I think we should move on to the depression questions.
Brings us to why we're all here. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Oh man.
I think we're done. We'll just call it a night right there.
Paul, would you like to start us off?
Sure. So I think maybe one of the first questions I have is you have a patient in your office and you have the suspicion for depression. Perhaps their, you know, PHQ-2 is positive. Before you actually start really digging into the diagnosis, is there any sort of routine lab work or workup that you do prior to actually sort of further investigating a diagnosis of depression?
You know, the book would say that you should screen them for thyroid abnormalities, screen people for adrenal insufficiency, diabetes, particularly if the patient complains of a lot of fatigue. But I have to say that in general, I have found those to be low yield. I mean, the reason that I would screen for those abnormalities often in primary care is mostly because so many of our patients have those illnesses. But I tend to not necessarily think automatically about screening out patients' medical conditions for when I'm considering a diagnosis of depression. And I know that is A, completely not evidence-based, B, completely antithetical to what the ACP and the APA screening guidelines say. But I guess I've just found them to be low yield. If a person comes to me saying they're gaining a lot of weight, they're losing their hair, and they have edema, then I might screen them for thyroid abnormalities in addition to treating their depression. But those are the things that it is said you should screen for. I can't tell you that I do them incredibly consistently.
I think a lot of those patients would have other signs and symptoms of adrenal insufficiency or diabetes or thyroid.
Most certainly. But the book says you should. So, you know, we try to be children of the book.
Yes. Yes. Well, I wanted to ask a little bit then, when you are approaching somebody that you think might have depression, where do you like to start? Are there tools or questionnaires that you would recommend that are easy to use?
You know, in the literature, particularly in the primary care literature, the PHQ-9 has really kind of roared to prominence. And frankly, I would say that there is no reason that you shouldn't use the PHQ-9. It can be used to diagnose depression, to track improvement of symptoms, and it has a decent coverage of symptom domain. So I actually think the PHQ-9 is pretty good. I often for myself use the Beck Depression Inventory. I think a lot because when I was training, we tended to use it a lot. So I can't necessarily say that it's better than any other. In fact, there have been a couple of meta-analyses that have been done of the Beck versus the PHQ-9 versus a couple of other questionnaires. And frankly, the PHQ-9 has never been found to be inferior to any of those more complicated scales. In general, I would just say anything that you use should be relatively short. The PHQ-9 fits that category. So does the Beck Depression Inventory. And a self-report is easier to administer. You know, you can tell the patient, whenever you come back to me next, while you're waiting to be triaged, you can do this in the waiting room. So it gives them something rather than just looking at Sanjay Gupta. Is Sanjay Gupta in every waiting room or just our waiting room? I think that instead of having to just look at Sanjay Gupta, they can actually do something that contributes to their treatment. So I like the PHQ-9. I like the Beck Depression Inventory. Those are probably the two that I spend most of my time using.
How did we include Sanjay Gupta into this?
Well, he's a famous doctor.
Oh, is he checking in for depression?
And he's on every single one of those like never-ending recordings in everybody's waiting room. I don't know, maybe not yours. Maybe you've been saved from that. But certainly in our waiting room, there's like this never-ending loop, and Sanjay Gupta is on every hour like a hit song.
I think we have the Learning Channel on ours.
Cashlack has HGTV play.
That's right.
That's HGTV. What I see.
I'd almost prefer that.
That would be so much better.
We haven't been giving our patients any relevant information while they're in the waiting
room.
That's
right. Maybe that's why they're not depressed when they see us, though.
Right. So this is where the PHQ-9 can fit in nicely. You know, it takes maybe 10 minutes to do it. Sometimes I've often thought whether or not a good screening tool also would be trying to figure out how long it takes people to do the PHQ-9. Because I've often found that if you keep having to go back in the room and they're not done yet with their PHQ-9, it's sort of a bad sign. I'll call it Marius's sign once it's validated. But I've often found that giving them something to do can be very helpful while they're waiting. And that's why I like those screens.
How about the geriatric depression scale? It's also relatively short, and personally, I use it when I'm working up dementia, but is that something that you use for select patients?
Oh, yeah. I definitely use it for almost all of my geriatric patients. So, you know, loosely defined as patients 70 and over. So I use that pretty regularly. I would say that I use the other two more regularly, but in older patients, I'll tend to use the geriatric depression scale. And again, it is self-report, short, and it can be used to track the progress of symptoms.
All right. And so after you've done all the lab work, you found out that the patient has a normal ferritin. You feel fairly confident in your diagnosis of depression.
Thanks, Paul.
So how? I'm here for you, Stuart. So how? How do you sort of choose initial agents? So you know, it's the HRQ says the second generation antidepressants all have fairly similar efficacy and about the same response rate. So how do you pick an agent for depression initially, and do you do anything to sort of incorporate shared decision making into that decision?
So the shared decision making is a double-edged sword. Obviously, I definitely use shared decision making with every conversation about starting an antidepressant. A, to get buy-in. B, to allow the patient to feel like you're not sort of pushing them towards medication. Because if there's a complaint that I'll often get is that patients feel like their doctor pushed them into doing medication when they might not necessarily have been comfortable with it. So I think it aids rapport. It helps with answering the patient's questions. But the double-edged sword is that I often find that patients will focus very much on the side effects of medications as opposed to the potential benefits. And I have not found that, frankly, when I tell patients about other kinds of medications. So shared decision making is kind of the cornerstone of initiating treatment, but I have found that it can be a double-edged sword. The other thing that I think is important is expectation setting. So it's really important to let the patient know things are not going to get better very rapidly, to sort of give them an outline of what feeling better will feel like to them, and particularly with respect to time course. And so time course is something that I focus a lot on. And then I also focus a lot on not stopping medication. You know, something like 25% of people stop their medication within the first week, and in total, maybe 50% of people stop their medications within the first 3 months. So what you're basically getting is 50% of people stopping medication before medication can even be effectively found to have succeeded or failed. So I try and do a lot of expectation setting.
Some places have guidelines where you're really supposed to call at 2 weeks, check in with the patient. How are you doing on the medication? Do you have any side effects? You might be able to coach them through them. And also, you can potentially go to the next step in the dose, or at least that's my practice, to go up on the next step in the dose at 2 weeks and then see them back in 1 month when they're on the medication, just to try to prevent that early dropout.
That is certainly what the guidelines say that you should do. Your question, forgive me, I cut across you. Do I have a specific?
What's your tact? What have you found is practical? Because that 2 week phone call, it's kind of hard to, do you do that? Or do you have a system set up in your practice to kind of make sure patients aren't stopping at that 1 or 2 week point?
I think what I try to do really, because when I see patients for psychiatric reasons in our clinic, I try to have enough slack in my psychiatric schedule that I could bring people back in 2 to 3 weeks. So I try to physically bring people back in 2 to 3 weeks. At a practical level, that is very hard. If you have a decent or a nascent collaborative care system within your clinic, all the evidence suggests that just that phone conversation with somebody who has some comfort and familiarity with taking care of psychiatric patients will suffice. That person does not need to physically be seen back in the office. But I would say I try to physically bring them back within 2 to 3 weeks at the outset. But it can be difficult. I think at a practical level, I would say most patients are coming back between 4 and 6 weeks. That's certainly not consistent with the guidelines, but I think it's probably consistent with real life.
So I made a rookie mistake and asked you, I think, 3 questions at the same time. So going back to initial agent choice, you know, you mentioned sort of the role of shared decision making. What other factors play into sort of what the first thing that you choose for a patient is?
I happen to practice in a clinic right now where there are a lot of patients who are fairly indigent. And so cost becomes a very important driver. So in that regard, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are far and away my number one choice. Within that group, the side effect profile, all things being equal, would be sort of the second choice. The third thing that I would think about also is, does this patient have a history of success with a particular agent in the past? So if that person has a particular success agent in the past, I would go immediately to that, no matter what category of antidepressant comes from, because then you can navigate through questions of side effects, both expected and unexpected. You know that the patient has tolerated it probably at higher doses than you're going to introduce. So previous success is probably the number one, is the thing that I think about all the time. But side effects and cost are probably the primary practical drivers these days.
So across the board, is any one antidepressant agent any more effective than another?
So the data has unfortunately seemed to demonstrate that there really is no superior agent. There is a signal in the data that escitalopram, more commonly known as Lexapro, may be a better antidepressant in that the time to remission is about a week faster. The time to response is about a week faster as well. But if you then look at large meta-analyses, that signal is not consistent. Mm. The SNRIs, your selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, have been consistently shown to be better agents in patients who have some kind of neuropathic pain syndrome. So you can group that group of sort of diabetic neuropathy. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you said selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. Is that like Strattera?
No. SNRIs. Duloxetine and venlafaxine.
So the serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor.
Yes. I was mixing my agents there.
That's okay.
I suppose it's a metaphor in my mind for the fact that the data shows that they're none right. is better than the other. But yes, the SNRIs have been shown to be better in patients who have some kind of underlying neuropathic pain syndrome. But that is the only consistent signal of superiority among these agents.
What about for, say, weight loss? If someone has a history of trouble with weight loss, is there any evidence to suggest, say, Wellbutrin or bupropion is a better agent?
So you're asking if the person has lost weight as part of their illness?
Well, no, let's say you have an obese patient who's depressed. Does that ever come into your thought process to consider an agent that's more associated with weight loss like bupropion?
It certainly does come into my thinking. I have to say that the aggregate data about bupropion is not as exciting for weight loss. It is much more weight neutral.
Okay.
Is probably a better description of it. So patients definitely do not gain weight. Some lose weight, but it is not necessarily as robust if you look at all the data. You sort of think of it as a medication that where people lose weight, but it really in actuality doesn't appear to be that way.
I see that. And for your geriatric patients, do you consider mirtazapine, or do you have an agent that you consider more often?
Not necessarily. I actually think about SSRIs more often in geriatric patients. They're often afflicted by vegetative symptoms, and SSRIs help vegetative symptoms much more quickly than some of the other agents. So, for instance, your mirtazapine, they often are as sleep inducing as a mirtazapine can be. They can cause weight gain in ways that mirtazapine does as well. However, mirtazapine does seem to cause a much faster recovery of appetite. So if you look at weight gain SSRIs versus mirtazapine over, say, a 12-month period, the weight gain is about the same in the aggregate, but the mirtazapine weight gain tends to be sooner than the SSRI weight gain.
So at what point do you consider augmentation or using an additional agent on top of the initial monotherapy?
So we've actually had, you know, in the past few years, for most particularly the STAR-D study, or, you know, sequenced treatment alternatives to reduce depression, they did a very good job in a very naturalistic way of looking at this question of augmentation. And it turns out that augmentation was equal. So just to remind your listeners, STAR-D started out by starting everyone on citalopram. And then those who did not remit were randomized to venlafaxine, sertraline, and bupropion. And it turns out all those agents were equal. Then those patients who did not remit were then placed on bupropion augmentation. And it turns out that bupropion augmentation, about a third of patients remitted there. So in all levels of the STAR*D study, about a third of patients remitted. The general practice is that if a patient has some response, so say a 50% decrease in their PHQ or a 50% decrease in their Beck depression inventory, that augmentation is probably equal to changing to another agent. So for me, I tend to see if a patient has some response, but not robust response, then I will use an augmentation strategy. And bupropion tends to be my first line augmentation strategy. Although there are, you know, atypical antipsychotics, for instance, quetiapine and aripiprazole are also FDA approved for augmentation strategies. But sometimes, but not every primary care practitioner is comfortable with an atypical antipsychotic.
So I'm aware of an article that was published in 2010 that there's a few articles that look at this for using adjunctive treatment with bupropion to remit some of the sexual side effects associated with SSRIs. Have you seen this in your practice at all? Have you seen any improvement in some of the sexual side effects for SSRIs with bupropion?
I'll answer this in two ways. One, bupropion, the studies that have been done on this question do not actually seem to bear out the idea that bupropion augmentation can improve sexual side effects. Certainly, bupropion as an agent by itself has essentially no sexual side effects. That said, and I don't know if this is just, what is it, selective memory, that when I have done bupropion augmentation, I have found that patients have complained less of sexual side effects. But to be clear, the data seems to indicate that the idea of using bupropion to remit sexual side effects of an SSRI doesn't actually have much evidentiary basis.
Mm. And I just want to try to recap a little bit of what you've said so far for the listeners, and just to make sure that I'm following too. Well, in the STAR*D trial, and I think some of the other research studies, a response was defined as a 50% decrease in whatever the baseline score was. Like if you were using,
correct,
in that study, they weren't using the PHQ-9, but let's say someone had a score of 14 on the PHQ-9. If they dropped that by 50%, that would be a response, and a remission,
correct,
is some arbitrary low number where the patient's not having minimal symptoms. And
I think technically for the PHQ-9, for instance, I think the score is 5.
5, okay.
Yeah, which is remission, yes.
I think that'll be helpful for people. And what you were saying is if people have a response, so 50% reduction on the PHQ-9, but they're not at that less than 5, they're not in a complete remission, you might think about augmenting therapy with one of these agents we've been talking about, bupropion, or potentially aripiprazole or Abilify. Is that, am I following?
Correct. You are picking up what I'm putting down.
Good job, Matt.
What is another agent other than bupropion? Are there other agents that you think that a general primary care or internist should be comfortable using?
So, again, STAR*D is very helpful in this regard. Mirtazapine was used as an augmentation agent in that study. I think also T3, iodothyronine, was actually used as an augmentation agent in that study. I mention those only because I think that internists tend to have more familiarity using those kinds of medications. However, I would say that the T3 augmentation strategy is somewhat dubious in my view. There are other things that you can use to augment, for instance, but then we're starting to get a little bit more into your specialty psychiatric strategies. Lithium, for instance, has been used as an augmentation strategy. It's a very powerful, it's a very good antidepressant, but it does come with its own set of baggage.
I think in STAR-D, they also use nortriptyline, but one of the things in the second step, they added to citalopram, they added cognitive behavioral therapy. We haven't really talked about non-pharmacologic treatment, but maybe this is a time to talk about that a little bit. How much are you using that in your practice, and are there certain patients where you will use that as monotherapy?
The guidelines say, and I think the evidence pretty much supports this, that in your patients who are on that borderline score between mild and moderate, so your mild to moderate depression, that you can offer a psychotherapeutic intervention instead of a pharmacologic intervention, and those are equal in terms of efficacy. Then the effectiveness of psychotherapy as a standalone strategy basically tapers off once you get to your moderate to severe depressions. Now, as a practical, you know, you ask an important question: how much am I using it in my practice? And frankly, the answer is not as much as I would like to, for two reasons. The availability of trained therapists is really leaves something to be desired. And I found that, you know, I've worked now in a couple of different cities, and it's the same in each circumstance. Many therapists do not take insurance, so many are cash only. And, you know, $100 an hour for 12 weeks, you know, soon we're talking about real money. So the availability of the therapists is a challenge. The other thing, too, is CBT, as it has been properly studied, is a very organized, manualized modality. There are many therapists in the community, you know, all of whom, you know, have the best of intentions, who do not necessarily deliver the most consistent manualized CBT. So some therapists will say that their work is influenced by CBT. I'm not sure what influenced means. You know, I could say my hypertensive therapy is influenced by beta blockers, but I don't know what that means. So the difficulties that I have found has been availability in terms of cost and numbers, but also just, you know, what makes for a good therapist, and how do we know that therapist A is good versus therapist B? You know, just because a person charges $150 an hour doesn't necessarily make them a good therapist. So there is a fair amount of trial and error there. But yes, I actually do try to offer psychotherapy to as many of my patients as I think will be able to access it. And frankly, that probably means that I end up offering it to fewer than I should, because of my own biases in terms of my thoughts about their ability to access it.
I have one comment and then a question to follow up. So I've noticed that patients, you're asking a depressed person to look through a gigantic list of people that are going to charge them a lot of money to talk to them. It's kind of you're fighting an uphill battle there. I find it's really, I'm like, did you call? And they're like, no. Yeah, and I get it. I mean, they have no motivation. They're depressed, and then they're not motivated to give someone a whole bunch of money, and it's not easy to find people. There's usually long waits as well. But my question was going to be, in other areas, we've talked to people about sleep. There's online CBT for that, and I know that for certain pain conditions, there's online CBT available. Is there, as far as you know, for depression, are there online courses or resources that people can use for this?
You know, I'm not aware of them. I am aware of some of these online CBT courses being used more, you know, more so, particularly among, you know, it's odd to say, among your managed Medicaid populations, which is, which is interesting. I know, for instance, that, and I'm not endorsing a program here, but just to say that I know that, for instance, there are programs administered by the insurance company Magellan So Magellan, for instance, has an online suite of therapy tools that its patients can, that their patients can access. I am not specifically aware of that, although there is a lot more talk about just in general harnessing the power of telepsychiatry. But I'm not aware of sort of good, validated, organized programs that the general public can access.
I guess the only other thing that I do recommend for patients, and I have no idea if this is part of the guidelines as well, it just kind of goes along. A lot of these people have pain as well. I'm always trying to get them to do some sort of activity, trying to get them to work on their sleep. Are these things that you're doing as well for depression? Is that part of the guideline-directed therapy?
Oh, definitely. I think that sleep hygiene is so critical. Trying to get the patient to change some of those maladaptive behaviors that they are in control of. I try and couch it as a self-empowerment tool, you know, to say that, hey, I can give you medication, but here's something that you can do and that you don't need my help to do it. So I definitely do do a lot of counseling about sleep hygiene. I have had less success, I will say, with trying to help patients do more activity in terms of, for instance, physical activity. What I can say that I do try to do is I try and strategize with the patient about planned outings for themselves. So, for instance, if they know that a particular, if they like the St. Patrick's Day parade, you know, I try and talk with them about the fact that, well, you should go to that. And how are you going to get there? What's your transportation? Are you going to talk to somebody about accompanying you? And try and game plan for those things. Takes a little while for you to develop that rapport with a patient so that you can know their interests. But I do try and get the patients to do a little bit more in terms of planned activity that they enjoy.
And as part of sort of the comprehensive plan for treating, and specifically with the medications, I guess, sort of how long do you treat for initially? And, you know, and can you talk to us a little bit about titration as well?
I try to titrate. I try and use the start low, go slow philosophy with all patients. So not just your geriatric patients, which is how we tend to think of that, which is where we tend to think of that approach. I try to give the patient a titration instruction, usually around 2 weeks. So I'll tell the patient, you know, you're coming back to see me in a month. Why don't you increase this dose at this particular point? And I try and write my prescription to reflect that. I try to tell them that we're going to try and get to a particular target dose. The classic teaching has always been that a patient, that you want the patient to be at least on a maximally tolerated dose for 6 to 8 weeks. So, for instance, citalopram, a target dose might be 30 milligrams. So you want the patient to be on 30 milligrams for at least 6 to 8 weeks. However, the data suggests that there are positive effects even out to 12 weeks. So the contemporary thinking is that you want to give a patient a robust 12-week trial. Of course, you have to do a lot of expectations management, a lot of telephone management of side effects and questions the patient might have about the medication. But I would say 12 weeks at a reasonably tolerable dose.
I see a fair amount of patients that they just seem to have been on citalopram 40 milligrams and they're on it. They're not questioning that they're on it and they just keep taking it. At what point should we think about withdrawing or weaning patients off that agent?
So there are sort of two parts to the answer, maybe three. So one, if a patient has had a single episode of depression, their relapse likelihood within 5 years is 50%. Two episodes, it's about 70%. And if you've had more than three episodes of depression, essentially relapses assured within the next 5 years. So take that into account as your first step. The research now seems to indicate that at least 9 months, perhaps 12 for a first episode. Beyond that, frankly, the data is not very good in terms of telling us how long we should keep a patient on an agent. There have been studies which seem to indicate that the longer a patient is on their medication, the less likely they are to relapse compared with cohorts who, for instance, are tapered at 1.5 years, 2 years, 2.5 years. So this question of what to do beyond a year, particularly for your first episode, for your non-first episode patient, is really kind of unclear. This is where shared decision making really comes into play. I have had patients that go, you know, doc, I didn't like how I felt when I was depressed. This medicine has helped me. If it's all the same to you, why don't we keep going on with it? That is the minority of patients, I will say. The majority of patients will try to taper off the medication after about a year, because I tend to be fairly honest with patients and tell them, we have evidence out to a year. You know, you've had 4 episodes of depression. I would say that you should stay on this as long as you can. But the evidence base for how long patients should remain on medications isn't the best.
I wanted to just briefly ask you about screening. I've heard that you're always supposed to just make sure, and I have to say I don't always remember to do this, just screen for prior manic episodes before you're doing a treatment course.
Sure.
Is that potentially low yield?
It's low yield until you have one.
Yeah.
Right.
Can you please justify my bad behavior, Dr. Kramer?
Right. Right. That's what I think I just heard. And the answer is no, I can't. I can't justify your bad behavior, Dr. Watto.
I'm rolling the dice. It's just a matter of time.
I would say that.
I will say most of my patients are in their 70s. So if they had bipolar, we probably would have seen it by now.
Right. They should have declared themselves by now. Right. I will say there is a good validated screen for bipolar disorder. It's the MDQ, the Mood Disorders Questionnaire. And you can just Google it and, you know, well, I hope that, you know, maybe
we'll put it in the show notes.
Right. So it's the Mood Disorders Questionnaire, and the sensitivity of it is fairly high, so that a patient who has a positive MDQ has a fairly good, a negative MDQ essentially means that this patient has no bipolar disorder. So I tend to use the MDQ in any patient who I have some inkling, some suspicion about. In general, though, you can also just ask, you know, have you had the elevated mood experiences for 2 weeks? Have you ever been hospitalized for something other than depression? And that is, you know, and documenting that is probably sufficient. Most patients who are bipolar spend most of their sick time depressed, and so they will tend to report that more. And so if you at least ask the question, then you can at least say that, you know, you did do a screening. But I have tended to use the Mood Disorders Questionnaire with fair regularity for ruling out bipolar disorder.
I just along sort of similar lines, it's screening for suicidality. I wonder if you could sort of share with us your approach for that, what kind of questions you ask and how you ask them, and who you worry about.
You know, I think I worry about, I mean, the demography is a very good guide here. We know that males tend to complete suicide more. We know that a person who has had a past attempt at suicide is very likely to have a future attempt at suicide. White males complete suicide more, as well as patients who have recently had a traumatic event, loss of a child, loss of a marriage, loss of a job. So the demography will sort of help you guide, will help guide you in terms of who you ask more pointed questions towards. I just simply ask, have you ever thought about hurting yourself? Have you ever thought about killing yourself? How often? How would you do it? You know, what keeps you from doing it? Patients who cite children or religious faith tend to have a much less likelihood of actually going on to attempt a suicide. Interestingly, being married with children is more protective for women than for men. Women will cite their children and their husbands as reasons to not commit suicide. Men will cite their wives being able to be there for their children as a reason why they would suicide. So that is a that is just an odd little wrinkle, but it's something
cats?
To keep.
What about cats? Is there any association with cats?
And does the number of cats matter? Please tell me no.
no comment.
I think if you own cats, that's a kind of a warning flag right there.
So I use the demography, and I'm very upfront in asking about the question with every single person.
So one thing that's really plagued us as primary care providers is just how difficult it is to get our patients to see specialized psychiatric care. And sometimes when they see it, the care that they get is sometimes dubious. So what can we do as a busy primary care provider in order to meet the needs of our patients before they see the specialized and maybe the appropriate psychiatrist?
This wades right into the deep right here. This is probably the greatest barrier. This is probably the greatest problem that primary care doctors have in terms of getting proper treatment for psychiatric patients. And unfortunately, it's a nationwide problem. The things that you can do, one, if you can, hiring. I actually think it is worth it to hire dedicated staff, perhaps a staff of two persons, one or two persons, to actually do ongoing management and outreach for your psychiatric patients, so that this staff would handle essentially handle your panel of psychiatric patients to make sure, and not doing many sort of highly sophisticated things, but making sure that patients are going to their appointments, they're taking their medications, they are attempting to find the psychiatric care, because as Matt mentioned, it can be daunting to flip through this large book of psychiatric providers. And so sometimes just having that extra push, if you can afford it, if you can afford to have it in your practice, is important.
Yeah. I was going to say, during a future roundtable, we could talk about different coding tips in order to get this
paid for.
Yeah, correct. Exactly.
Right. There are some new CPT codes, mm-hmm. usually in the setting of your more formalized collaborative care systems. So, so either a practice that has an embedded social worker, behavioral health specialist, and then maybe has a consulting psychiatrist. So getting to know the psychiatric practitioners in your area is probably an important thing to do, so that you can bounce questions and build your own capacity as a psychiatric provider, because you're not going to be able to refer every single patient. Let me see. What else? More training. There are, for instance, psychiatry for primary care conferences. So, you have to sort of bone up for yourself in terms of what you can do in treating these kinds of patients. But I have to say that, the options for doing more as a primary care doctor are limited out there, limited by access, limited by resources. And just to put it, just to get on a soapbox, until we as a nation get a little bit more serious about funding mental health care and funding it equal at a level equal to the way we fund Well, first of all, we have to get more serious about primary care, first of all, and then funding our mental health systems at a level equal to how we would like to have our primary care infrastructure funded. We're going to have this continual problem.
So this is at least my last question before I have some questions from Facebook. And maybe it's a little bit of a divergence, from stage left, I guess, if you will. But what are some of the warning signs that you might see amongst colleagues? And how would you recommend pursuing those or helping them to seek care?
So that is an interesting question. I think changes in their professional behavior and demeanor, so higher levels of irritability than normal. If your colleague used to be, you know, is the person who they're always on time, they're always prepared, they're often calling back their patients very quickly, and all of a sudden that starts to slip. So there, you know, decreases in their professional conscientiousness, I think, is what is probably the thing that I worry about the most in terms of colleagues. As far as helping them to seek care, I think the direct approach is best. You know, I think sometimes we forget that we are human beings too, and this is a human activity. So you pull aside a colleague and you say, I've been concerned, you know, is everything okay? You know, you don't say, you know, how much alcohol are you drinking? Like, right. you know, that doesn't go over very well. But you say, this is what, you know, I have been concerned. I am worried. How are you doing? And allow them to open up to you. You can't necessarily allow them to come to you, because as doctors, we're not necessarily inclined to do that. But you go to the colleague who you're concerned with and you say, hey, I'm concerned, and allow them to open up to you. I have to say that I've not had this experience in my professional life. Maybe, you know, I'm almost a little thankful about that. But the advice that you hear, particularly from professional groups, is be very, very direct.
So I'll say from my experience, I've actually treated this a few times with colleagues, and I found that what works best is actually to consistency in following up with them. So checking in with them, making sure that they've accessed the resources that you've brought to their disposal, and then sometimes even taking them to the resources is what I found to be very helpful in helping them to seek care. And I've been, at least at this time, 100% successful in getting these cases taken care of with very good results.
Well, glad to hear it. I think that certainly if a physician is in a physician or a nurse or a staff member in your clinic is in a position where they're willing to open up, then I think they certainly are very motivated to seek treatment. So I have to say that I have yet to, actually, no, that's not true. I did have one, not a physician colleague, but I did have a staff member who had a psychiatric problem and wanted help treating it. And it was, frankly, we thought that the best service I did for him was actually to have him seek psychiatric care somewhere else, because it was clear that following up on our campus, around our offices, was more difficult for him than seeking care outside. And so once he sought care outside, things got a lot better.
And I think that's probably one of the big barriers for a lot of healthcare providers that have mental illness. They don't want people to see them getting help, going to a psychiatrist's office. And so there probably is a barrier there, just because of concerns about their ability to carry on in the profession if they're having those issues. So I think it's a really tricky problem.
It is a tricky problem, but I also think that, you know, congratulations to your colleague here for being able to take on this problem, you know, as well as he has, because it's necessary. You know, physicians get sick, and so that when they do, they need the help.
Yeah, Stuart's not, since I've known him, he's not the kind of guy to just let stuff go.
No, not at all. No.
Well, great.
He will say something.
Well, good.
Well, sir,
and then drive you to the appointment.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I'll go in there with you. In fact, we'll just have a shared decision-making together.
Right.
No, that's an excellent story.
So I've got a couple of questions from Facebook, if you have the time. These are really short.
Sure.
So one is, it says, if you have a teenage patient who has a prior history of suicide attempt, and let's say they were taking their antidepressant medication, but they dropped off, they stopped taking it, and then during that time that they're off their medication, they had another suicide attempt, is it safe to put them back on the same medication that they were on before?
So just to make sure I'm getting the question, they were on an agent and stopped it, and the suicide attempt occurred while they were off the agent.
Correct. Yes.
Yes. Yes. It is safe to put them back. In fact, a number of years ago, when there was some controversy that led to the black box warning on antidepressant inserts for suicidality among adolescents, there was a noticeable decrease. There was a noticeable decrease in prescribing of antidepressants to that age group and a noticeable concurrent increase in completed suicides among that age group. So the aggregate data as well as the individual data would support putting that patient back on their medication.
That's good to hear. And then the other questions were answered in the middle of our discussion here. I have one last question. I have no idea what he means by this. The question is, did it depress you? I'm guessing he means the discussion we had.
Did it depress you?
I'm not sure if that's not a good question. Yeah. Sorry, Dave.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
It did often.
Okay, good. I will let him know it did often.
I think we were mostly depressed that you don't have a DJ name. Yeah. If we go back.
Yeah.
So the answer is yes.
Okay, yes. The answer is yes. DJ MC no longer exists.
Marius, could you... I think this is a good time to wrap up so that you can get some sleep before you're woken in the middle of the night by a crying child, or hopefully that's not still happening, but maybe
it
is.
Don't text me like that. No, he's sleeping more. He's sleeping more. Thank you for asking.
Okay. How about some take-home points, just to kind of wrap things up nicely for the audience here, about that you'd like them to remember when they're treating depression?
I guess the first point would be it is really important to get into the habit of screening. And the screening question is, the screening questions are very simple. Do you feel depressed or do you feel anhedonic? So screening is recommended, particularly in circumstances. The screening guidelines says, quote, in circumstances where you have the infrastructure to treat the patient. And one can quibble over what that means, but get into the habit of screening, one. Two, antidepressants do work. So there are some doctors out there who just feel like, antidepressants are the biggest placebo scam ever committed against the American people. And that's not true. Antidepressants do work. But it takes time and it takes a lot of expectations management with the patient in order to successfully treat. Three, early referral to a psychiatrist, I think, is important, particularly if you think that you're not making much progress. One, it'll allow you to access that specialty care. And two, it'll allow for a lag. It means that the lag in getting to a practitioner will not be as impactful for the patient. And then four, I think it is important to actually measure your outcome. We would never have a patient come into the office and not check their blood pressure. We would never have a patient come into the office and they're diabetic and we don't check their blood sugar. So we should measure depression if we're treating depression. And I think that will help normalize the process in the patient's mind. And then finally, our patients are great ambassadors for psychiatric care. So I also encourage the patients to tell their family members, tell their friends that they were treated, because you never know when that family member or friend can catalyze treatment in another family or friend or acquaintance who's really needing it.
All right. I think that's a great way to end the show. Thank you for all your advice on this, and maybe we'll have you back to talk about anxiety, because that's another topic that we've gotten a lot of requests for. It seems that people definitely, hopefully they'll be a lot more comfortable treating this problem now, and hopefully we can do the same for anxiety on a future episode.
I'm anxious to talk about it.
I certainly would love to. It is actually a whole topic in and of itself, and I'd like to thank you for having me. I really appreciated it.
All right, Marius, Paul, I was leaving.
Pause.
I was.
Yeah, right. That was straight.
I just wanted to hang out there.
We're expecting Paul to chime in.
Okay, goodbye.
Yeah. No.
Well,
thanks, Marius. That was great.
This has been another episode of the Curbsiders.
All right.
Bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole. You can find show notes along with links to any articles, books, websites, or apps mentioned on the show at thecurbsiders.com/podcast. We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, so we want your input. Please send us an email to thecurbsiders@gmail.com. You can subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, or you can follow us on our page on Facebook or on Twitter at The Curbsiders. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Watto.
And I'm Dr. Stuart Kent Brigham. Thank you for listening and have a good night.
And I remain Dr. Paul Williams. Good night.
Oh, hi, Paul.